Dorothy Kilgallen rose to prominence as a journalist in the mid-1930s. By the end of the decade, her daily column would capture the attention of East Coast readers before blasting her further into popularity through nationwide syndication. By the 1950s, she was an icon of the newspaper business, as well as a radio show host and television celebrity. In an era when journalism was dominated by male personalities, Dorothy shattered glass ceilings and became one of the most well-respected and popular journalists in the world. While her beginnings were in the direction of Hollywood gossip columns, her true passion was for investigative journalism, covering controversial stories and figures of the time. Her coverage of major murder trials was acclaimed, and her defense of those she felt were given a raw deal brought on criticism and argument, but Dorothy was not afraid to speak her mind, nor to stand up for what she believed in. The subject of lawsuits and feuds with celebrity royalty, and even the United States government, Dorothy never hesitated to voice her opinion. In 1963, the United States was forever changed when President John F. Kennedy was killed by an assassin's bullet in Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd. Dorothy was devastated, not just at the loss of a president whom she admired greatly, but John was a personal friend she had gotten to know years earlier. While the world watched the story unfold, from the arrest and murder of Lee Harvey Oswald to the trial of Jack Ruby and the release of the Warren Commission, Dorothy dared to ask questions at a time where it was not popular to do so. She dedicated the last years of her life to investigating the assassination, became the only person to get a private interview with Jack Ruby, and compiled an extensive dossier on the murder, all while being under FBI surveillance. She was questioned by intelligence agencies, but never revealed her sources. In early November of 1965, Dorothy quietly told some friends that she was taking a trip to New Orleans to speak with an informant, and she was going to break the case wide open. Unfortunately, she would never make the trip, and instead would be found dead in her New York City townhouse. Questions linger about the scene of her death, the manner in which she died, and what may have happened. Her dossier on Kennedy, with all of her extensive notes, vanished and has never been located. And for many, there is more to the story than has ever been revealed. What happened to Dorothy Kilgallen? Was it an accident? A suicide? Or did someone wish to silence the intrepid reporter? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 54, The Mysterious Death of Dorothy Kilgallen. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today I examine the mysterious death of Dorothy Kilgallen. It's a little different from your average episode, and it's filled with theory, rumor, and a great deal of history and controversy. Before moving into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcatcher. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at traceevpod, on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, transcripts, social media links, merchandise, and much more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you'd like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. Today I examine a case which has stuck with me ever since I first heard the story as a child. It's a highly complicated story, with a lot of names and angles involved, but at its center rests one of America's sadly forgotten icons, and one of my personal inspirations. This is episode 54, The Mysterious Death of Dorothy Kilgallen. Dorothy Mae Kilgallen was born on July 3, 1913, in Chicago, Illinois, to parents James Lawrence Kilgallen and his wife, Mae Ahern. James was a reporter who had worked for many different news services over the years, having begun as a telegraph operator when he was just 15 years old. James' dedication to the news and his rising status as one of the most well-known and respected reporters in the country would have a tremendous impact on Dorothy and her future. As a young child, Dorothy was defined as inquisitive and constantly learning. For James and May, it was clear that Dorothy had an aptitude for knowledge from a young age. She especially enjoyed being read to, and with James as a reporter, he would often read the newspaper aloud for his young daughter. Due to the changing nature of James' career, the family was on the move a lot from Dorothy's early years. James worked, among many side reporting jobs, for the Chicago Tribune as a neighborhood reporter. He would later change to the Associated Press and then the United Press, and even acted as the managing editor for the Indianapolis Times for a period. Around the beginning of America's involvement in World War I, circa 1917, he became the co-owner of the Daily Boomerang in Laramie, Wyoming. The Kilgallen family, by 1919, had expanded to include another daughter, Eleanor, who would be 6 years Dorothy's junior. While still young herself, Dorothy was drawn to her little sister and doted on her alongside her mother. The family settled into a more permanent residence in 1920 when the International News Service brought James on as a roving reporter based out of New York City. While the Kilgallen family had been somewhat acquainted with life on the move, the children had shifted things, and whether he knew it or not, James' days of wandering the country working for various papers were over. He would ultimately work for the International News Service for the next 38 years. Of the major stories James covered, they included the Lindbergh baby kidnapping and the German surrender in World War II. The Kilgallen family were Roman Catholic, and so the children were raised in the church. At the time, the United States was experiencing a rampant anti-Catholic movement. While much of this anti-Catholic sentiment was most fierce in the southern states, there was still a sideways glance cast at Catholics in the north. In the late 1920s, Al Smith became the first Roman Catholic to gain a major party's nomination for president. But his Catholicism came quickly into play, with many arguing that Smith wouldn't take his orders from the American people, but would instead be at the beck and call of the Pope. Interestingly, it was this very vehement anti-Catholic point of view which resulted in a surge in Catholics showing up at the polls to vote Democrat in defense of their religion. The Kilgallen family settled in Brooklyn upon arriving in New York, and it was a very transitional place at the time. 1920, the year of their arrival, saw the ratification of the 18th Amendment, which employed a federal ban on alcohol in what has often been referred to as Prohibition. In major cities such as New York, the ban on alcohol resulted in the surging of the underground and the growth of organized crime, with bootleggers getting rich and wars between rival factions shedding blood in the streets. While the world around them seemed to be chaotic and questionable, James and May worked hard to provide a good upbringing and happy home life to their children. Brooklyn is the most populous borough in New York City, covering 97 square miles. In the 1920s to 30s, Brooklyn's population boasted more than 2.5 million residents, not very different from the current population today of 2.7 million. Brooklyn was a diverse area of New York, and at the time was experiencing large growth with schools, colleges, and businesses being constructed. Suffice it to say, Dorothy grew up in an ever-expanding borough in the shadow of Manhattan, where her father traveled each day for work. James was an admirer of culture, and it wasn't uncommon for the family to go into Manhattan to attend shows on Broadway, something which fostered a keen interest in theater for Dorothy, which would develop throughout her life. Dorothy's zest for learning and her curious nature set her up well for school, and she attended primary school in Indianapolis and Chicago prior to arriving in New York. Throughout the early years, Dorothy obtained high marks and specifically showed an aptitude when it came to writing, for which she was said to have possessed the talent. Much like her father, Dorothy had a natural ability to weave a story and to entice a reader, and this was an area she would pursue further as she entered Erasmus High School, located on Flatbush Avenue. Around this time, in 1929, the stock market crash occurred and America entered the Great Depression. While this hit many hard and resulted in mass homelessness and the rise of tent towns around the country, with New York seeing a massive one in Central Park, the Kilgallen family managed their way through as James' work as a reporter only increased. As Dorothy neared completion of her time at Erasmus High School, her interest in writing continued to grow and now encompassed journalism as well. Due partially to the influence of her father and her own innate desire to learn and share her knowledge, the possibility of a career as a reporter began to develop. Despite Dorothy's burgeoning intellectual prowess and dedication to the craft of writing, she had many obstacles to overcome. Dorothy would graduate from Erasmus in 1930, not exactly a time where it was easy for a woman to get a jump start in the field of journalism, a highly male-dominated career at the time. In spite of this knowledge, Dorothy had a reputation for her tenacity and dedication to her goals, and while the road may be difficult, she was determined to break through whatever barrier might lie in her path. Dorothy went on to attend the College of New Rochelle, a private Catholic college. Her pursuit of journalism was vivacious, and her writing had sharpened dramatically in the last few years. And the brilliant 19-year-old was certainly showing the potential to be an incredible reporter. Her tenure in college was short-lived, though, as she dropped out when she was offered a job, working as a reporter for the New York Evening Journal. While Dorothy's skill was of no doubt, it has come to be believed that this original offer came through the influence of her father. The Hearst Corporation owned the New York Evening Journal, as well as James' newspaper, the International News Service. Regardless of how Dorothy found her way into the business, her skill and talent for writing and investigating would galvanize her place and erase any snide remarks about nepotism. While Dorothy's articles were intriguing, it would be her involvement in a race which would catapult her from lesser-known writer to media darling and coast-to-coast columnist. 65 years before the television show The Amazing Race debuted and showed teams racing around the world, Dorothy Kilgallen was one of three New York reporters, and the only woman, who embarked upon their own race around the world. The rules were simple. The reporters had to traverse through their destinations using only transportation publicly available. The race, which was a joint venture between the newspapers and the airlines, aimed to show the ease with which one could circle the globe thanks to modern transportation, specifically airplanes. Each reporter would write articles in installments, detailing their journeys and the adventure set out before them which they would then cable over to their papers for publication. The National Aeronautic Association was responsible for tracking the time, and the race kicked off on the evening of September 30th, when each of the participants left their respective offices. The first goal was to reach Lakehurst, New Jersey, where the participants would board the famous Hindenburg Zeppelin, which would be destroyed in a tragic disaster less than a year later. It was a bad night, with heavy rain, forcing each racer to drive to the site rather than fly. Kilgallen was the last to arrive, but nonetheless, the trio were then ushered by dirigible to Frankfurt, Germany. Sometime during the trip, Kilgallen struck up a friendship with fellow reporter Leo Kieran, and the two followed much of the journey together. After Frankfurt, the next targets were Italy, followed by Hong Kong. Kilgallen and Kieran went their separate ways in Bangkok. Following Bangkok was Hong Kong, Manila, Honolulu, and then the race back home to New York. Ultimately, Kilgallen came in second, arriving back in New York having gone around the world in 24 days and 12 hours. Kieran finished last, having taken 2 hours longer than Dorothy, while Herbert Eakins of the World Telegram won, though there was some dispute about the manner in which he won, having talked himself onto a Pan American airline flight, which was for crew only, breaking the rules about using publicly available transportation. Regardless of the fact that Eakins had completed the race in just over 18 days, it was Dorothy Kilgallen who received most of the pomp and circumstance, and quickly was elevated into the position of being a role model for women across the country and an inspiration to a generation, showing her female counterparts that she could compete with the guys, and they could too. The race resulted in Dorothy becoming a spokeswoman for airlines, and shortly after returning, she collected all of the articles she had written during her trip, added in some personal thoughts about the race, the locations, and the adventures as a whole, and released it as a book entitled Girl Around the World. The book was a success for Dorothy, further increasing her already growing celebrity status, and was later credited as inspiration for the film Fly Away Baby. In the film, Glenda Farrell plays reporter Torchy Blaine, based loosely on Kilgallen. The movie, released in June of 1937, depicts Blaine's attempt to solve a murder and smuggling case while on an around-the-world flight, and was quite successful as the second film in the Torchy Blaine movie series, with a third film following later. Prior to the release of Fly Away Baby, Dorothy stepped in front of the cameras herself, playing a reporter in the 1936 film Sinner Takes All, starring Bruce Cabot. Throughout this rise in popularity, Dorothy continued writing columns and considered being a reporter her true career. As the 1930s drew to an end, the Evening Journal, for which she wrote, merged with another paper, The American, and Dorothy began writing a daily column called The Voice of Broadway for the newly formed New York Journal American. The column appeared for the first time in 1938. While the columns were originally based around New York show business news and gossip, Dorothy would frequently insert more serious work, covering politics and organized crime. The columns were so well received, and Dorothy was now gaining more traction, that they were eventually picked up for syndication, and soon, the once New York-only columns began appearing in 146 newspapers nationwide, increasing Dorothy's reach and boosting her already bolstered popularity. The success of the articles was so financially rewarding that Dorothy moved her family, with whom she was still living at the time, from Brooklyn to Manhattan. In late 1938, early 1939, Dorothy was working on a column about a new musical called The Knickerbocker Holiday. It was during this time that she met and began a relationship with one of the actors in the play, Richard Kalmar. Kalmar had been involved in entertainment for a while, though he hadn't truly been connected to any major hits. Some have argued that Kolmar may have viewed Dorothy as a way to shoot himself into stardom on the coattails of her celebrity, while others have stated that it was a whirlwind romance which encompassed both of them. Kolmar converted to Catholicism for Dorothy, and on April 6, 1940, 30-year-old Kolmar married 27-year-old Kilgallen, who would retain her maiden name in print and popular culture. Dorothy and Richard would embark upon several journeys together, one of which involved the growing world of radio broadcasting. Richard eventually joined a nationally syndicated radio drama in which he played Boston Blackie, a hard-boiled detective with an edge. For Dorothy, her Voice of Broadway column would be utilized to create a CBS radio broadcast of the same name. As America entered World War II, following the attack on Pearl Harbor, Dorothy's radio show was growing in popularity, and over the course of the next few years, both Dorothy and Richard would build their radio reputations. In 1945, the two decided to go in on a joint venture, a daily morning radio show entitled Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick. The show would air Monday through Saturday from 8:15 to 8:55 a.m. and between 11:30 and 12 on Sundays. The show was quite ahead of its time, considering today's world of podcasting. The two broadcast from their apartment, and through Dorothy's career and celebrity status, she had connections to advertisers, and so the two would frequently promote books, movies, and plays by discussing them as topics on the show. Here's a clip of that radio program.
Good morning, darling.
Good morning, sweetie.
I hope you noticed Julius's face when he ushered our guests in this morning.
I did. Well, it's 8:15, and this is Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick, coming as usual, direct from our apartment on 66th Street in New York. And today we're very happy to have at our breakfast table two friends who are also neighbors. They're Leo DeRocha, who needs no introduction in this neck of the woods, and his very beautiful wife, Mrs. DeRocha, otherwise known as Lorraine Day. Now, here we are.
Yes, here we are, and I think probably the first thing that I've got to do, not only for the members of our household, I know Mary is lurking in the doorway trying to get a peek at Mrs. DeRocher, and I know that all the members of our audience will want to know what she's wearing, and it being a very chilly morning in New York, she has on a tan skirt, beige skirt, and a violet-colored sweater set, high-necked sweater, and also a cardigan on top of it. And she looks very pretty.
Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick began in their 16-bedroom apartment, located at 640 Park Avenue, and later followed them to a brownstone at 45 East 68th Street. This morning show would outlast other similar radio endeavors, being conducted by the couple for over 20 years. Over the next few years, Dorothy's popularity would continue to rise. The syndication of her column, her work on broadcast radio, and her connections to Hollywood kept her name prominent in the public forum. In 1948, she worked on a broadcast with the wildly popular Frank Sinatra, though the two would later have a falling out when Dorothy wrote a comprehensive tell-all about Sinatra's life. Sinatra would be only one of many major names with whom she would have difficulties. She had a legendary feud with Jack Parr, the second host of The Tonight Show, and the precursor to Johnny Carson. By 1950, it was estimated that Dorothy had nearly 20 million readers around the country. While she was a fine writer, many have attributed her success to an innate ability to get information that others weren't in possession of, bolstering the gossip aspect of her column. According to insiders of the time, Dorothy was consistently approached by agents to plug and promote the activities of their celebrities. Dorothy didn't believe in giving out a free promotion, and in order to do so, she has been alleged to have said to these people, quote, "Bring me three detrimental stories concerning other stars, and I will include a good piece about your client," end quote. This typically wasn't a difficult requirement to meet, as the competition between rival stars was intense, and the ability to smear a competitor was quickly taken up. In 1950, Dorothy made yet another splash in the public eye when she was invited to be a panelist on a new television game show entitled What's My Line? The game show involved a four-person celebrity panel asking questions of a guest in an attempt to determine their occupation. Over the years, the show became wildly popular and saw many celebrity mystery guests, including the likes of Sean Connery, John Wayne, and Julie Andrews. Here's a clip of Dorothy's first introduction.
Here to my right is my favorite Broadway columnist and girl about town, Dorothy Kilgallen.
Thank you. I would like to introduce that wonderful toastmaster, raconteur, and former governor of New Jersey, Harold Hoffman.
Dorothy would serve as a panelist from the inception of the show until her death 15 years later. For many who knew Dorothy, both in print and by her voice on the radio, this introduced them to another side of her, and it was clear that in the world of celebrity, while Dorothy was not quite as widely known as movie stars of the time, she was one of the most well-known female figures in America. Just a few years later, while Dorothy continued to write gossip columns, she began to expand her investigative side and to publicly explore many areas which would bring controversy and criticism. In 1954, Dorothy covered the murder trial of Dr. Samuel Shepard. If that name sounds familiar, it's because the arrest and trial of Shepard became the basis for the television series The Fugitive, which was later made into a film starring Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones. Shepard was ultimately arrested and found guilty of bludgeoning his wife to death in their home in the Cleveland suburb of Bay Village. Dorothy, though, disagreed with the verdict and wrote front-page stories pointing out questionable evidence and criticizing the prosecution. This stirred up a lot of controversy, and at least one Cleveland newspaper stopped carrying her column in response. Dorothy was exceedingly outspoken about the case and wrote extensively. She argued firmly that there wasn't enough evidence to convict Shepard and that there was a good chance the real killer had gotten away. While she was publicly against the determination of the trial, it wasn't until after the judge, Edward J. Blythen, passed away that she publicly revealed that he had told her, before the trial had begun, that he believed Shepard to be, quote, guilty as hell, end quote. When Dorothy was approached by attorney F. Lee Bailey about this statement, she agreed to be deposed, and that deposition played a major role in later getting Shepard's conviction overturned, and at a retrial, Shepard was found not guilty. Bailey later wrote in his memoirs that Shepard had met Dorothy at a late-night party following his release, at which point he thanked her for her ardent investigative work and defense of his innocence. This incident, though, would not be Dorothy's only brush with controversy, and if nothing else, signified a turn in her reporting. It's been suggested over the years that Kilgallen, like many popular news reporters of the time, had connections to the Central Intelligence Agency in terms of receiving tips and information from the agency in exchange for popular support of covert and military activities. As the tensions between the United States and the communist-overrun Cuba were beginning to increase in the late 1950s, Dorothy wrote a number of anti-Castro stories in her columns. Some of this information is rumored to have been given to her through first-hand accounts in direct interviews with Cuban exiles based in Miami. Some of these exiles would later participate in the failed Bay of Pigs invasion. The U.S. military, CIA, and other assets had set out to train, arm, and supply the exiles with what they needed in order to deliver them to the Bay of Pigs in Cuba, from which point they were to launch an offensive with the goal of overthrowing Castro. This came after an alleged series of plans worked on jointly by the United States government and the mafia to assassinate Castro. While much of this information was very unknown to the public and still is debated today, it was considered anti-American to speak of at the time. But Dorothy released a column on July 15, 1959, in which she became the first major journalist to suggest publicly that the CIA and Mafia may be working together. The article did not sit well with higher-level military and intelligence agents, and it's been reported that the head of the FBI himself, J. Edgar Hoover, was angry about Dorothy's writings. From this point forward, her activities would be kept track of, and the FBI initiated a dossier on her. Many friends of Dorothy's from this time onward have spoken openly about how it became a running joke that if Dorothy called, they knew the conversation was being listened to and that the phones were being wiretapped. In September of 1959, Nikita Khrushchev, leader of the USSR, became the first Soviet leader to visit the United States. During this time, Khrushchev would have a face-to-face meeting with President Eisenhower in hopes of calming down tensions between the two countries. Dorothy wrote a scathing article about the visit in which she attacked the style of Khrushchev's wife, writing, quote, "The grisliness of her attire amounts almost to a demonstration of piety. It would be difficult to find clothes comparable to hers in the waiting room of a New York employment agency for domestic help. In this decadent capitalistic republic, applicants for jobs as laundresses, chambermaids, and cooks usually are far more a la mode than Russia's first lady." End quote. The article ignited such fervent backlash that, for a time, Dorothy thought she may have to cease publication and resign. With a mirrored similarity to current day reports, Dorothy remained staunch in her anti-Russia stance and continued to write about Khrushchev, Castro, communism, and much more. Despite the backlash, just months later she would create another controversy. In an article published on December 22, 1959, Dorothy suggested that another female reporter, Elaine Shepard, had been involved in an extramarital affair with a member of President Eisenhower's White House staff. The story came out of a European trip conducted by the president, in which 83 members of the Washington press group went along. Shepard was the only female reporter involved in the trip. She later sued Dorothy for libel, looking for $750,000 in damages, alleging that Dorothy had, quote, "maliciously implied that she was a person of lewd and unchaste character," end quote. This lawsuit was the beginning of a long and bitter feud between the two women. In 1961, Dorothy went back to covering a trial revolving around another murdered wife. In 1959, Raymond Bernard Finch was a married 40-year-old surgeon living in West Covina, California, with his wife Barbara. He hired an 18-year-old woman, Carol Tragoff, as his receptionist. The two initiated an extramarital affair a year later, and the affair slowly began to change, with the two discussing the possibility of a permanent relationship. Tragoff, who was married at the time, had no qualms about divorcing her husband, but for Finch, it was more complicated. Based on California law, were he to divorce Barbara, she would be entitled to half his assets, and likely more if it were established in court that he had been unfaithful. At 10 p.m. on July 18, 1959, Finch and Tragoff arrived at the Finch residence on Lark Hill Drive. An hour later, Barbara arrived home and her husband approached her. Reportedly, a dispute broke out between the two, and Barbara was shot and killed by a .38 caliber handgun. At this point, Finch and Tragoff separated, with Finch stealing two cars along his way to Las Vegas. Tragoff arrived the next day, but later on in the evening, the two were caught and arrested. Finch was charged with first-degree murder, while Tragoff was charged with second-degree. The first trial resulted in a deadlocked jury, reportedly due to racial tensions amongst the jurors. There would be a second and even a third trial, with both eventually being found guilty. Tragoff went on to serve 8 years, while Finch served 10, ultimately having his medical license reinstated in 1984. By the time that the third trial had begun, most of the major media outlets in the country had moved away from the story, but Dorothy stuck with it and won acclaim and praise for her coverage. Her columns regarding the trial were noticed by Random House co-founder Bennett Cerf, also one of her co-panelists on What's My Line, and he reached out to Dorothy about a book deal. The book, later titled Murder One, would contain Dorothy's coverage of six murder trials throughout her career. While Kilgallen is listed as the sole author of the book, there has been some dispute about it in the years since, with Cerf's widow later stating that the book had actually been authored by Alan Ullman, and that Dorothy's name had been attached purely for publicity's sake. Dorothy then turned her attention to a new controversy being stirred up, which involves celebrities and officials attending so-called sex parties. Most newspapers picked up on the story and ran with it, and the story became a major scandal in England. One of Dorothy's articles stated, quote, "The authorities searching the apartment of one of the principals in the case came upon a photograph showing a key figure disporting with a bevy of ladies. All were nude except for the gentleman in the picture, who was wearing an apron. And this is a man who has been on extremely friendly terms with the very proper queen and members of her immediate family." End quote. While sensationalist in style, Dorothy worked just as doggedly at this article as she had on ones with major implications. In March of 1963, Dorothy was rushed to the hospital due to an unknown illness, which was later determined to be anemia. Some have debated publicly whether or not this was a cover story for alcohol problems, a pill addiction, or possibly even a mental breakdown. In her absence, Richard continued on with their morning show, though without Dorothy, popular opinion decreased, and the show ended the next month, ending their 23-year-long run. While from the outside, public opinion of Dorothy's marriage seemed to suggest a loving engagement, those close to the couple were aware of severe marital problems. They had three children over the years, Jill, Richard, and Kerry, and seemed to be living a blessed life. But as is often the case, the truth beneath the gleam of celebrity life was darker. Richard was said to have engaged in numerous extramarital affairs and may have even fathered children out of wedlock. It was said that it was common for him to dip into their bank accounts to frequently pay out hush money to these women. There's a famous story that Dorothy actually walked in on one of these affairs, taking place in the couple's own bed, and that from that day forward, she refused to ever sleep in that bed again. While they kept up appearances publicly, it appeared that they were very much no longer in step, nor did they consider themselves married privately. Throughout her illustrious career, Dorothy had made friends with a great number of celebrities and public figures. One friend in particular was future President of the United States, John F. Kennedy. The two had met through a mutual friend, Florence Pritchett. Friend may be the wrong term, though, for while she was friends with Dorothy, she was one of JFK's mistresses. The two struck up a friendship, and Dorothy became close to Kennedy, and through their friendship, she gained a great deal of knowledge and insight. While she was a gossip columnist, among other things, she refused to cover the more questionable stories about Kennedy's extramarital affairs. On August 3, 1962, she wrote a mysterious article in which she discussed a prominent man in politics engaging in an affair with Marilyn Monroe. She never named the man, though the public automatically assumed it was JFK. Dorothy would later allege that she'd actually not been talking about John, but rather his younger brother and then Attorney General, Robert Kennedy. Dorothy became the first journalist to discuss this story, which internally was well known at the time. Back then, newspapers often kept things such as this secret in order to protect the president or other popular names, but all of that would change. Some have debated whether Dorothy elected to write this piece, or if in fact she faced outside pressure to do so. Shockingly, just 2 days after the article was published, Monroe was found dead, and Dorothy began to wonder if those who had urged her to write the article had done so in hopes of smearing the Kennedys. Rumors began circulating that Bobby had had Monroe killed in order to protect the secret. On November 22, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas, while his motorcade moved through Dealey Plaza. Lee Harvey Oswald was later arrested for the murder of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit, and then also charged with the assassination of Kennedy. Oswald was, in turn, shot and killed by Dallas criminal and club owner Jack Ruby before he could go to trial for the assassination. Dorothy was absolutely devastated by the news, having not only been friends with Kennedy, but also a staunch supporter of his administration. The shock to the country was astounding, and even today, those who were alive remember where they were when they learned of the assassination. It was a flashbulb moment for the United States, and perhaps even the world, and goes down in history as one of the most controversial incidents ever. 7 days after the assassination, President Lyndon Johnson assigned the President's Commission on the Assassination of President Kennedy, which would later become known as the Warren Commission, since it was chaired by then-Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren. In the years since, many have stepped up to question the veracity of the claim that Oswald was the lone assassin, let alone the quality of examination conducted by the Warren Commission itself back in 1963. Few people imagine that the government would conceal the truth about such a major incident, let alone possibly play a role in the assassination itself. Dorothy Kilgallen, though, was never afraid to follow her gut, and to her, something was wrong with the official story. Being a reporter with a great deal of knowledge and experience in covering major crimes and trials, she quickly became fixated on gathering information about the assassination while also focusing in on the pending trial of Jack Ruby. One of her first acts was to reach out to a contact she had in the Dallas Police Department. She was given transcripts of all Dallas police radio communication the day of the assassination, and in those transcripts, Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry stated, quote, "Get a man on top of the overpass and see what happened up there," end quote. Kilgallen later wrote an article that Curry had lied to the media when he had told them that he believed from the first moment that the shots had been fired from the sixth floor of the school book depository where Oswald was said to have been. It would be Dorothy's investigation into the Kennedy assassination which would stir up the greatest amount of controversy in her life. And just 2 years after Kennedy was shot, Dorothy herself would be found dead under circumstances which some have argued to be highly suspicious. Those 2 years' worth of research and investigation into the most dramatic crime of the time would leave many with unanswered questions, and lead others to believe that Dorothy's insistence and outspoken criticism of the police, the Warren Commission, and the government itself could possibly have made some want to silence the country's most popular and well-known woman reporter. Jack Ruby was found guilty of the murder of Lee Harvey Oswald on March 14, 1964, and with the attention she had paid to the trial, Dorothy found herself with more questions than answers. She began digging deeper into the assassination and started trying to arrange a meeting and interview with Ruby himself. The Warren Commission report was released initially in an 889-page report in September of 1964, though in November, the entire report would be released in a 26-volume text consisting of supporting documents, depositions from over 552 witnesses, and more than 3,000 evidence exhibits. Interestingly, Dorothy had someone inside the commission who was passing her information. Prior to the official release of the report, Dorothy received a 102-page segment specifically detailing Jack Ruby's involvement with the commission. She wrote several columns in which she released this information, allegedly so that when the official report was released, these details would have to be included. In response to these columns, the FBI began investigating the leak and sought out Dorothy for answers. They were already maintaining a dossier on her, but now it seemed that their interest was more heightened. Dorothy was extensively interviewed, though she was later reported to have said, quote, "I'd rather die than reveal the source," end quote. In an article published on September 30th, 1964, Dorothy wrote about the encounter and then added that the FBI, quote, "might have been more profitably employed in probing the facts of the case rather than how I got them," end quote. She would later write in another column, quote, "The American people have lost a beloved president. It's a dark chapter in our history, but we have the right to read every word of it," end quote. It was shortly after the publication of the leaked pages that Dorothy was contacted by Mark Lane. Lane himself was interested in the JFK assassination and felt that the investigation had been poorly handled and that there was evidence of a cover-up. Lane would go on to publish several books on the subject, including his 1966 release, Rush to Judgment, which was a scathing indictment of the Warren Commission. Lane put Dorothy in contact with Thayer Waldo, a journalist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram who had information he was afraid to publish. According to Waldo, he had discovered that a meeting had taken place just 8 days before the assassination at Jack Ruby's Carousel Club. The meeting was alleged to have been between Ruby, Officer J.D. Tippit, who was murdered hours after the assassination, and Bernard Wiseman. Unlike her contemporary, Waldo, Dorothy published the account of the meeting. According to her, Waldo had told her he was in possession of other information, but he feared for his life were he to share it. Later, after publication, Dorothy implied that the Warren Commission had been made well aware of this meeting, but they had elected not to dig into it, as their information indicated that a fourth man had attended. What his identity was hasn't been revealed, though he was alleged to have been an important figure in the Texas oil business. Dorothy published several articles questioning the Warren Commission's approach, and then accused both the FBI and the Dallas Police Department of threatening witnesses and altering their testimony. On September 25, 1964, Dorothy published an interview with Akilah Clemens, one of the witnesses to the murder of Officer Tippit. In the interview, Clemens contradicted the official story, saying that she distinctly saw two men running from the scene of the murder, and neither resembled Oswald. She was afraid to discuss it too deeply, stating, quote, "I'm not supposed to be talking to anybody. Might get killed on the way to work," end quote. Clemens may have had reason to fear, as from 1963 to 1970, more than 30 individuals connected to the assassination would die from gunshots, unsolved murders, and mysterious accidents. Some of these were witnesses, others were simply associates of either Oswald or Ruby. Dorothy then approached one of Jack Ruby's co-counsel, Joe Tonahill, and requested that he deliver a message to his client. The message was said to be from a mutual friend, and upon receiving it, Ruby agreed to a one-on-one conversation with Dorothy. Tonahill later stated that the mutual friend was from San Francisco, and while the identity has never been confirmed, some have alleged that it may have been Mike Shore, a co-founder of Reprise Records. Dorothy Kilgallen became the only person to ever gain a private interview with Jack Ruby. Ruby's lawyers and even the prison guards agreed to wait outside. The interview lasted only 8 minutes, and Dorothy never officially released exactly what Ruby told her. Friends would later say that Dorothy told them that following this interview, she was going to blow the entire Kennedy investigation wide open. Dorothy believed that the information she had was going to be a major scoop, and so she didn't want to tell anyone else who might rush to publication before she could. In June of 1964, Dorothy met Adam Ronald Pataki, a film and drama critic for the Columbus Citizen Journal. According to friends, Pataki approached Dorothy and asked her if she was Claire Booth Luce. The two hit it off and began an alleged romantic affair, which was kept secret. Some have said that Dorothy was suspicious of Pataki, believing that he may in fact have been a spy working for the FBI or CIA, who was attempting to get close to her. For many, Pataki was unknown at the time, and he was frequently referred to as the out-of-towner, or Dorothy's mystery man in Ohio. It was an interesting relationship, with Dorothy being 12 years Pataki's senior and living halfway across the country, but the two found ways to meet up. Pataki has said that he worked with Dorothy on some of her investigation into the JFK assassination, and that he met her a number of times in the Regency Hotel, a location which will become important later. Pataki, however, denies that their relationship was ever romantic, insisting that the two were just friends. Around this same time, Dorothy was experiencing some financial difficulties. Her husband had made some bad financial investments, and they no longer had the income from their morning radio show to fall back on. For a period of time, she began to worry that they might actually lose their home in New York, and so this drove her harder to keep her information secret, believing that the financial gain she could make when she finally published would set things back in order. Unfortunately for Dorothy, she would never get the opportunity to publish a single word of her report. She had been investigating the case for well over a year, and in October of 1965, she told Mark Lane that she had found new information in New Orleans. She planned to visit an informant in the coming weeks, but she would be found dead before the trip could take place. It's important to note that Lee Harvey Oswald had spent time in New Orleans, and Jim Garrison, the former district attorney of Orleans Parish, would become the only man to bring a case against an alleged conspirator in the assassination, though he would ultimately lose that case. According to Ramparts magazine writer David Welsh, Dorothy had told him that, quote, she vowed she could crack this case, end quote. Another friend of Dorothy stated that Dorothy had told her, quote, in five more days, I'm going to bust this case wide open, end quote. At the same time, Dorothy was growing paranoid of the eyes and ears she believed to be following her. She had subtly revealed that she'd received information showing a connection between Ruby and Tippett, as well as information that David Ferry played a role in the assassination. Ferry would later die under strange circumstances after speaking with Jim Garrison. She handed a draft of some of her Kennedy investigation notes to her friend, Florence Pritchett, then Florence Smith. When asked why she was doing this, Dorothy pointed to what had happened to Bill Hunter and Jim Koth. Hunter and Koth had been looking into the assassination, and both had visited Jack Ruby in jail. On April 23rd, 1964, Hunter was shot dead by Creighton Wiggins, a police officer, in the press room of a Long Beach police station. Wiggins initially claimed that his gun had fallen and accidentally discharged, though this was proved impossible in court. Wiggins then claimed he and a fellow officer, Errol Greenleaf, were playing a game of quick draw when he'd accidentally shot Hunter. Greenleaf alleged that his back was turned at the time, and he didn't see what happened. Both were later convicted and sentenced to 3 years probation. Jim Koth moved forward and had planned to publish a book about the assassination, but his life ended on September 21st, 1964. It was later determined that someone had broken into Koth's apartment and killed him with a blow to the throat. On November 7th, 1965, Dorothy had plans to tape an episode of What's My Line. The show was taped live in the evening. According to her makeup artist and close friend, Mark Sinclair, she was in an upbeat mood and was her usual fun and kind self. The episode taping went forward without issue, and Dorothy headed out to grab a drink after the show, as was customary. Dorothy had no way of knowing this would be her final appearance on the show. Here is a clip of her last appearance.
Panel, I will admit we're being tricky, and we have perhaps 3.5 minutes to see what you can do. We'll tell you that Miss Kane is self-employed and deals in a service, and we'll begin with Dorothy Kilgallen.
Could I use your service, Miss Kane?
I think so.
Could Mr. Randall?
Yes.
You're quite sure about him, aren't you?
Reasonably.
Well...
You may be, Miss Kane.
if we had need of your service, would we go to you rather than ringing you up and summoning you?
You would have to take the initiative to utilize the service, yes.
All right. If we took the initiative, would she come to us?
No.
Is there anything entertaining about your work?
I would say yes.
You would, and I would agree with you. Are you in the communications field?
Yes.
Are you in radio?
No.
Is she a writer?
Yes. Right. Good. And good night, Dorothy Kilgallen.
Good night, John. Good night, Tony. Please come again.
I will indeed. Thank you.
After the taping, Dorothy met with Bob Bach, a close friend at an establishment known at the time as P.J. Clark's. According to Bob's wife, Jean, after several cocktails, Bob offered Dorothy a ride home. She allegedly requested to be dropped off at the Regency Hotel instead, possibly for a date, even maybe with the mystery man who many believe to have been Pataki. She was witnessed entering the lounge at the Regency Hotel sometime between midnight and 2 a.m. A witness who worked at the Regency alleged that he saw Dorothy enter at approximately 1 a.m. The last person to report seeing her that night was Catherine Stone, who worked on What's My Line. According to her statements, Dorothy was entertaining an unknown man. This mystery man, again, some believe to have been Pataki, though he denied seeing Dorothy the night she died, as well as having been at the Regency at all that evening. It's important to note that, at some point, tensions had grown between Dorothy and Pataki. She began to feel that while she had let him in on some of her secrets in the JFK investigation, he may have been leaking that information to others, including journalists back in Ohio. It's been said that Dorothy felt betrayed, and whether or not Pataki was able to convince her to meet him again, or perhaps to convince her that he had not been leaking information, we can't know for certain. It has been alleged that this also gave Dorothy a stronger feeling that Pataki may in fact have been spying on her. The next morning, on November 8th, at approximately 9 a.m., Mark Sinclair arrived at Dorothy's five-story townhouse in New York. He initially went to the fifth-floor bedroom where Dorothy slept every night, but she wasn't there. By what reason or how, Mark ended up on the third floor, where he discovered Dorothy in the master bedroom, the bed she swore she wouldn't sleep in again after her husband's infidelity. Interestingly, her husband was asleep in his usual room on the fourth floor. The two hadn't shared a bed in quite a few years. Dorothy was sitting up in bed, wearing a blue robe. She still had her makeup on, including false eyelashes and a decorative hairpiece. A book was lying in the bed beside her. When Mark attempted to wake Dorothy, he discovered that she wasn't alive. The 52-year-old woman, who had been dubbed the most powerful voice in America, was dead. From this point forward, contradictions and confusion about the scene, the possibilities, and the cause of death become hotly debated. The arrival of investigators has been debated, with some stating that they were called and arrived shortly after the discovery was made, and others suggesting that police actually didn't arrive until after they'd heard about Dorothy's death broadcast on local television stations. Upon arrival, investigators found little to lead them to believe that Dorothy's death was related to foul play. There were no signs of a struggle. There was no bruising or marks on Dorothy's body. While authorities felt the scene didn't depict anything out of the ordinary, Mark Sinclair disagreed. First and foremost, Sinclair stated that the bedroom that Dorothy was found in was not a room she ever slept in. The blue robe that she was found dressed in, he had never seen her wear before, and he had been there in the mornings to wake her up on many occasions. Sinclair also said that Dorothy never got into bed before removing her makeup, hairpiece, and fake eyelashes. The book, The Honey Badger, written by Robert Ruark, had been found open in the bed by her side and was one which she had already read, and in addition to this, her glasses were not located nearby and she was unable to read without them. Sinclair also told authorities that Dorothy had told him that she'd been receiving threats. Despite these claims from Sinclair, investigators didn't feel that they signified anything of great importance. There was, however, one question which remains at the core of the debate surrounding Dorothy's death today. The notes she had compiled for her book about the JFK assassination were never located. The file, which she kept either close to her or locked away, has to this day never been located and was missing from her room when her body was found. As previously mentioned, Dorothy had given a rough draft of some of the information to her friend, Florence Pritchett Smith. In a strange turn of events, Florence herself passed away just 2 days after Dorothy's body was found. Florence's death was ruled to have been due to a cerebral hemorrhage, and it was said that, at the time, she was suffering from leukemia. What notes Dorothy provided to Florence were also never discovered. Dorothy's husband, Richard, was questioned by authorities. According to his statement, which changed several times, he'd recalled Dorothy arriving home at approximately 11:30 p.m. Richard claimed that Dorothy was in good spirits and was heading to type up part of her column, and that that was the last he'd seen of her. Of course, witnesses placed Dorothy out still at 1 a.m. the night before she was found, which seems to call Richard's accounting of events into question. Examination of the scene found that, in a glass beside her bed, there were traces of Nembutal, a short-acting barbiturate which she was known to take. There was also an empty sleeping pill bottle. In what many consider a strange similarity, and others dismiss as mere coincidence, Dorothy's body had been found in a similar state to that of Marilyn Monroe, whose ultimate cause of death was determined to be a lethal combination of alcohol and barbiturates. When writing about Monroe's death in her own column, Dorothy had asked, quote, "If she was just trying to get to sleep and took the overdose of pills accidentally, why was the light left on? Usually people sleep better in the dark," end quote. Dorothy's light was also found to have been left on the night she died, and much like Marilyn Monroe, her death too would be attributed to an accident related to a lethal mixture of alcohol and barbiturates. Police determined, at the scene, that there were no indications of a homicide, nor did they believe this was a case of suicide, but purely an accidental death. Due to this determination, many steps of the investigation were either performed quicker than needed or outright ignored. For instance, they never dusted for fingerprints to determine whether or not Dorothy had entered the room alone that night, a point which many have argued about since the days after her death was discovered. Dorothy's body was removed from the scene so that the medical examiner could conduct an autopsy. During this period, her father, James, suggested to the public that it was possible she may have died as the result of a heart attack. Whether or not James believed this, had inside knowledge, or was simply attempting to cover up for the possibility that it was drug-related remains unknown, but he would eventually be proven incorrect. Even Dorothy's autopsy had questions surrounding it. While she had been found to have been in good health, and there were no indication that she had suffered a heart attack, her death was ruled to have been the result of acute ethanol and barbiturate intoxication. Interestingly, the medical examiner jotted handwritten notes beside this, stating, quote, "circumstances undetermined," end quote. That note would become the source of much debate and controversy, as some felt that it suggested that while Dorothy's death may have come as the result of alcohol and pills, there was some question about whether or not Dorothy had taken the pills willingly. The autopsy was conducted by New York City medical examiner Dr. James Luke, but curiously, it's not Luke's signature which appears on her death certificate. The signature on the certificate belongs to Dr. Dominic DeMeo. He was asked about why his signature was there and responded that he had no idea. He wasn't even working out of Manhattan at the time and played no role in the autopsy. The autopsy itself wasn't actually conducted in Manhattan, where Dorothy died, but instead, Brooklyn. Another strange detail in the medical examiner's report was the presence of nicotine. According to the report, large quantities of nicotine were found in Dorothy's blood, but there was an issue with this. Dorothy Kilgallen was not a smoker. While the cause of death had appeared to have been determined, there were some who disagreed with the findings that the death was purely accidental. Homicide investigator Jack Doyle, who had initially been involved with the case, stated that he didn't believe Dorothy's death was merely an accidental overdose. Doyle, among others, felt that the scene appeared staged. Not long after making these comments, Doyle left the New York Police Department and moved away from the state. Doyle would move a total of 6 times, and it has been suggested that each of these moves was precipitated by an author or reporter contacting him to discuss the details surrounding Dorothy's death. Another prominent voice involved in the case, Dr. Charles Umberger, toxicology director at the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, later stated that he suspected murder. This same man kept a beaker of fluid extracted from both Dorothy's brain and stomach. Due to the limitations of testing available at the time, this fluid would be stored on ice for the next 13 years before it would be examined more closely. Public response to Dorothy's death was somber and respectful, though some felt that the autopsy results painted Dorothy as an alcoholic drug abuser, which many in her life disagree with. Dorothy was known to throw back a few drinks, but it was never something that people felt was out of control or beyond normal means. As for the pills, Dorothy did have difficulty getting to sleep and was known to take prescribed pills to aid with this, but no one close to her has ever come forward to suggest that any kind of drug abuse was being conducted. Her fellow panelists on What's My Line paid tribute to Dorothy in their next episode, and here is a clip from that tribute.
Now, until next week, good night, Arlene Francis.
Thank you, John, and I just want to say that in the more than 15 years of Sundays that we've spent together on this program, we have become not just associates, but a kind of family. And so it is not so much as a co-worker that we miss Dorothy, though certainly she was a game player that was better than almost all the rest of us. It is really as a family that we are saddened by her absence. Good night, Steve.
Good night, Arlene. The fact that we didn't get any of the first three contestants tonight, John, establishes, as Arlene has indicated, that even just purely as a game player, Dorothy is very dearly missed. But, of course, that's not a very important consideration. She's missed as a human being. The world knows her as a very brilliant woman, very quick-minded and very intelligent, the writer of a very fine newspaper column. But we all think it's more important that she was also a very fine wife and a very fine mother and a fine human being, and we miss her in those capacities. Good night, Kitty.
Tonight I'm sitting in Dorothy's seat, but no one could ever possibly take her place. Good night, Bennett.
Well, a lot of people knew Dorothy as a very tough game player. Others knew her as a tough newspaper woman. When she went in for a story, nothing could get in her way. But we got to know her as a human being, and a more lovable, softer, loyal person never lived. And we're going to miss her terribly. John?
Good night, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being with us on What's My Line.
A mass was held for Dorothy at St. Vincent Ferrar, located on Lexington Avenue. The mass and funeral drew in 2,600 people, including many well-known names and notable personalities, including, but not limited to, Joan Crawford and Ed Sullivan. Dorothy's husband, parents, and children bid her goodbye, and she was laid to rest approximately 20 miles north of New York City at the Gate of Heaven Cemetery in Hawthorne, located in Westchester County. Her grave marker simply reads, Dorothy Kilgallen Colmar, beloved wife and mother. Just hours after the funeral, Bob Bach, who had been with Dorothy the night before she died, met with Richard and asked him about the JFK investigation. According to Bach, Richard responded, quote, Robert, I'm afraid that will have to go to the grave with me, end quote. While public grieving began drawing to a close, questions began to arise around the manner of Dorothy's death, spurring the NYPD to initiate a new investigation in January of 1966. The investigation would last a total of 8 months, and in September of 1966, the case was closed when investigators stated that they failed to find any signs of foul play. Dorothy's name began fading from the news, and while there were a great deal of questions left surrounding her death, her life, and the investigation she launched into the JFK assassination, time moves on and people forget. Just 5 years after her death, Richard died on January 7th, 1971, the result of an apparent suicide. Richard had been a heavy drinker throughout his life, and after Dorothy's passing, he increased the volume of his consumption. It was reported that he died in his sleep and that he had recently suffered a broken shoulder after falling in his home 3 days earlier. It's interesting to note that details about Richard's death are thin, with some blatantly stating suicide and others merely saying that he passed away. Regardless of the case, Richard was buried in the same plot as Dorothy, several feet above her. His name was not added to the grave marker. In 1978, biographer Lee Israel was working on a book about Dorothy's life. Through her investigation, she discovered that the fluid that had been taken from Dorothy's body was still in storage with the New York State Medical Examiner, and so she pushed to have it tested. The results came back with an interesting determination. While it had been known at the time that Dorothy had barbiturates in her system, the kind and quality was not previously known. New technology allowed for the ability to get finer detail, and it was determined that Dorothy died not as the result of a barbiturate, but of multiple barbiturates, three in particular, amobarbital, pentobarbital, and secobarbital. These were three slow-acting sleeping pills, and this initiated a theory that Dorothy's death may have been the result of someone slipping the pills into her drinks during her night out, and ultimately causing her death hours later. Further documents, later released, also indicated that the glass found on Dorothy's bedside did contain barbiturates, but not in pill form, rather powder residue, suggesting that someone had opened capsules and poured them into the drink. Dr. Michael Baden, who later would become New York City's chief medical examiner, told Israel that the dosage of barbiturates in Dorothy's system was not indicative of an accidental overdose. In fact, it was the equivalent to taking 15 to 20 100 milligram secanols. Over the course of the next 40 years, the debate would ebb and flow. Occasional documentaries would be released discussing the conspiracy aspects of Dorothy's death. Articles, usually written around the anniversary of her death, called attention to the story, but the more years passed, the greater the distance grew between accounts of Dorothy's life and death, which were slowly being replaced with articles debating the veracity of conspiracy theories. Somewhere in the mix, as the JFK theories grew more prominent, Dorothy's name began getting lost in the shuffle, and today, this woman who was once an icon of female power and prowess has been gradually brushed under the rug. Dorothy's children went on with their lives, growing up, remembering the woman who was their mother, while others considered Dorothy to be, perhaps, the woman who knew too much. Due to the urging of author Mark Shaw, and some information which he had released in a new book about Dorothy's death entitled The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, the Manhattan District Attorney announced in January of 2017 that they were going to take a look into accusations of homicide. More than 51 years after Dorothy was found deceased in her townhouse, the investigation would be re-examined for the consideration of possibly reopening it. Shaw felt strongly that the DA needed to speak to Pataki, 81 at the time. Biographer Lee Israel felt similarly, stating to the press, quote, "He had something to do with it," end quote. In addition to his suspicion of Pataki, Shaw has argued that Dorothy's death may have involved members of the Mafia, specifically Carlos Marcello. Much like the 1966 investigation into Dorothy's death, this one too lasted 8 months. In September of 2017, the New York District Attorney said that they had found no evidence to suggest that Dorothy's death was the result of a homicide. The DA's office said that they would be willing to examine any new evidence which could be provided in the future, but that at this time, they simply didn't have anything to point them towards foul play. When asked for comment about what they did find, the DA's office elected not to respond. 53 years after the death of Dorothy Kilgallen, her name remains inexorably connected to conspiracy theories, after she herself spent the last years deeply investigating conspiracy theories surrounding the death of her friend, President John F. Kennedy. The 1960s are known as a time of assassinations, with JFK being killed in November of 63, Malcolm X in February of 65, Martin Luther King in April of 68, and Robert Kennedy 2 months later in June of 68, along with countless others. Does Dorothy Kilgallen belong on this list? Or was her death, sadly, the result of an accident, a lethal combination of alcohol and barbiturates? There are three essential theories in the death of Dorothy Kilgallen. The first theory argues that Dorothy's death was in fact the result of an accidental overdose, and that all of the conspiracy aspects of the case are misplaced, and that while there are mysterious details about her death, this does not necessarily imply that anything sinister had taken place. Many believe that, in the absence of evidence which may have made things more clear, people have dug into a mystery that simply has no basis. The second theory suggests that Dorothy's death was neither an accident nor a homicide, but may have been intentional. Supporters of this theory feel that Dorothy had crumbled under the pressure, found herself addicted to pills and drinking heavily, while facing financial ruin and emotional distress, and that the brilliant woman elected to end her own life. Some have gone so far as to argue that Dorothy herself may have been responsible for some of the mysterious aspects, electing to do things out of the ordinary to raise questions about the manner of her death. The third and final theory has several different aspects to it, but ultimately revolves around the premise that Dorothy was in fact murdered. Some believe that Dorothy may have been murdered by her husband, Richard, whose career was trailing off and his drinking may have only increased his jealousy of Dorothy's time in the spotlight. Others believe that Dorothy may have been targeted by the Mafia, who feared what information she might uncover in her investigation in connection to the assassination of John Kennedy and their potential involvement working with covert agencies. Yet others believe that Adam Ronald Pataki, the man alleged to have been Dorothy's secret boyfriend, may in fact have either murdered Dorothy for unknown reasons, or perhaps even been working as a covert agent sent to infiltrate her inner circle. And the final aspect contends that Dorothy Kilgallen, having upset the intelligence agencies of the United States multiple times, had caused them to finally lash out, not knowing what information she may have uncovered, in an attempt to silence her and destroy all of her research. The life of Dorothy Kilgallen was iconic and dramatic. This tough, smart, and tenacious woman broke down barriers and shattered the glass ceiling for women in the media. It was through her hard work, dedication, and intellectually driven and thought-provoking journalism that she would become an A-list celebrity, sharing drinks with singers, actors, and the royalty of Hollywood. Despite the glitz and glam, her numerous appearances on television, and her few roles in film, Dorothy's first love was always journalism. She saw herself as a reporter, and for her contemporaries, they were in awe of her abilities and accomplishments. Dorothy was considered an incredible journalist with a unique style who brought new eyes to newspapers and new perspectives to stories. She fought for what she believed in, regardless of what public opinion might have been. She wasn't afraid to question the official story, to stand up to any authority which attempted to suppress her, up to and including her own government. She was an inspiration to women around the world, and set the bar by which so many have since measured themselves in the world of journalism and investigative reporting. She was a mother, a wife, a friend, a sister, and a daughter. Her family was remarkably proud of her achievements. They outlived Dorothy by many years, with her sister being the last to pass away in 2014. No matter what the question, they always had something full of pride and love to say about Dorothy. Whether the victim of a conspiracy, an accident, or her own choices, Dorothy Kilgallen should be remembered for what she achieved and the way in which she lived, rather than the manner in which she died. But perhaps the best way to honor Dorothy's memory is to ask the questions she herself may have sought the answers to look for the truth, regardless of the obstacles, as Dorothy herself may have done were the roles reversed. I personally love going to concerts and seeing musicians performing live. Rod Stewart and Cyndi Lauper are true music legends. They have been awarded nearly every industry award and honor for their unmatched catalog of hits. Don't miss this dynamic duo as they embark on a summer tour with a stop at the Reno Events Center on August 28th. For tickets, visit Ticketmaster.com or call 1-888-288-1833, presented by The Row and Harrah's Reno. Dorothy Kilgallen is one of the cultural icons of an earlier generation who, in current times, seems to have fallen into obscurity. In preparation for this episode, I reached out to several people and brought up her name, and none of them were familiar with her story. For a woman who broke such ground, established herself as a major figure in the news, and continued to live a life full of intrigue and curiosity, it's disheartening to learn how much of her name has seemingly faded from the spotlight. There were very much two Dorothys out there. The one on television, whose name sat at the top of hundreds of articles covering all manner of subjects, and then the private woman, the mother and daughter, who loved her family deeply and wanted to provide them with the best of everything. She lived a complicated life, being a prominent woman in the spotlight of 1950s and 60s television in Hollywood. Part of her job as a journalist requires a certain level of anonymity, but for Dorothy, that was simply an impossibility. There are countless stories of her striding into a courtroom to cover a case, at which point the lawyers for the defense, and even the prosecution, would be starstruck and asking for autographs. While her name gave her access to many doors she may not have found otherwise, it also inhibited her ability to work as privately as she may have wanted, especially with her work early on the JFK assassination. There have been countless films which depict the fictional world of 1950s and 60s America. Movies about incidents of cultural significance, spy dramas, love affairs, deception, and murder. Dorothy's life was an amazing story, and even at this current time, a film is being developed to depict her larger-than-life figure. Yet over 50 years after her death, on November 8, 1965, the answers as to how that life ended remain controversial and highly debated. In the absence of solid evidence, or at least enough of it to quiet the conspiracies, three primary theories have been developed to explore these possibilities. The first of these theories follows the official findings of police and medical examiners, that Dorothy Kilgallen's death was the result of an accidental overdose. When Dorothy was discovered in one of the bedrooms of her townhouse, there were a few pieces of evidence which seemed to immediately indicate to police that, whatever had occurred, drugs were involved. It was no secret that Dorothy had taken barbiturates to aid with her sleep, and considering the time of this occurrence and its proximity to the death of Marilyn Monroe, it wasn't a huge leap in logic for investigators to quickly assemble a similar scenario. According to their belief, Dorothy had been out drinking the night before, had returned home still inebriated, had taken pills to get some sleep, and the toxic mixture, one which she may have even danced along the precipice of in the past, broke the threshold of what her body could handle. This theory seems to be proven accurate when Nembutal residue was found in the glass at her bedside. Witnesses from the previous night did share details about Dorothy knocking back a few cocktails, though what she drank later, or how much, after her arrival at the Regency, remains unknown. All of that being said, it isn't exactly an impossibility that Dorothy may have accidentally overdosed in the manner in which it has been officially reported. There are questions, though, which seem to go without answers under this premise. Why would Dorothy have elected to have entered a bedroom she never slept in? Did she choose not to remove her makeup, eyelashes, and hair adornment on purpose, or was she so out of it at the time that she simply forgot? Did she select a robe she never used for a reason, or was it simply the first thing she grabbed? Without knowing Dorothy's state when she arrived home, it's difficult to ascertain the answers to these questions, and frankly, her husband's testimony about her arrival home that night is far from reliable. Then there's the book. Some people read to help them sleep, and perhaps Dorothy was doing just that with a book she'd already read. Maybe there was something in the book that she enjoyed, and she wanted to return to it. Is it possible that after trying to read, she felt that sleep wasn't going to be coming, and that she made the choice to take a few pills? Of course. The book makes less sense, though, when we discover that she didn't have her necessary reading glasses, and one detail that I've always found odd in the manner in which she was found. Dorothy wasn't laying in bed as though she took some sleeping pills in hopes of getting some rest. She was sitting up. The light was still on, and as Dorothy herself pointed out, people do tend to sleep better in the dark. So the scenario is difficult to imagine. Dorothy, wanting to catch some sleep, possibly still amped up from recording the television show a few hours earlier, and whatever entertainment she found that evening, reaches for a glass of water. Apparently, she does this while sitting in bed. She doesn't take the pills and then turn out the light, crawl under the blankets, and lay down to shut her eyes. She just sits up in bed. Apparently, she didn't have the time or presence of mind to prepare herself for sleep as she normally would, but she simultaneously had the consciousness to attempt to read a book without her glasses. While all this seems out of place and confusing, there could be explanations we simply aren't privy to. Maybe Dorothy was feeling a little too drunk and didn't want to waste time getting ready for bed by removing her makeup, eyelashes, and hairpiece. Maybe she ended up in the room not because it was her choice, but because it was close to where she was when she decided it was time to lay down. Perhaps that book was already lying on the bed before she even entered the room, and therefore it wasn't that she was reading it, but simply that it was there. Maybe Dorothy accidentally took one or two pills too many, or maybe she was even in the habit of breaking open the capsules and mixing it in a glass with liquid, and that was her preferred method, except this time, she mixed in too much. Maybe. Maybe is all we can really say about anything that happened in the room that night, because we simply don't know. While the accidental overdose was possible at the time, the examination of fluid taken from Dorothy's body in the aftermath seems to depict a different story. If Dorothy was said to have had the equivalent of 15 to 20 100 milligram Seconal tablets worth of barbiturates in her system, that doesn't sound like much of an accident. We don't know how many pills Dorothy was in the habit of taking, nor what her tolerance may have been, But the idea that anyone would consume 15 to 20 sleeping pills without the assumption that it might go badly seems unlikely. Dorothy had covered Marilyn Monroe's death. She was certainly familiar with what can happen when you mix alcohol and pills together. Some people felt that the scene was staged. Others believed that it was just a drunk woman taking one too many pills in a room she wasn't usually in. Of course, determining whether or not the scene was staged would have required investigative actions which were simply never taken. The presence of unidentified fingerprints in the room may have answered a lot of questions, or dispelled some myth, but fingerprints weren't dusted for. Richard's story, about Dorothy arriving at 11:30, which directly contradicts witnesses who place her out as late as 1 a.m., was allowed to slide by with little if any further probing. Threats, alleged to have been made towards Dorothy in regard to her columns and her JFK investigation, were dismissed as the work of angry readers who were little more than talk. And her missing JFK research? Well, there's two theories on that. Someone destroyed it, or Dorothy's husband maintained possession of it and never revealed its contents. Ultimately, we can't begin to get into the mindset of Dorothy Kilgallen. Any number of things could have occurred that night. Without further details, it's difficult to analyze, and unfortunately, anyone who may have been able to provide further information, for the most part, has long since left this world. While an accidental overdose isn't an impossibility, there do appear to be a number of unanswered questions that work against it. The sheer amount of drugs in Dorothy's system that night, for many, implies either murder by drugging or suicide. It was not exactly uncommon for the media and police to cover up the death of a celebrity in hopes of preserving their honor. Is it possible that the explanation for Dorothy's death was an accidental overdose in order to protect from news breaking of a possible suicide? Maybe. While the accidental overdose theory remains the official story, and no evidence solid enough has been found to truly call it into question, there are certainly a number of details which make that story suspicious for those who examine it. That leads us to the second theory, that while Dorothy's death may have indeed been the result of an overdose, that overdose may not have been accidental. While Dorothy was still riding a wave of popularity, her better years had certainly begun to fall behind her. The money she once brought in as a spokeswoman and radio host, coupled with her column and television appearances, was dwindling. Some due to changes in her career, some due to allegations of her husband's bad investments and aptitude for spending. Legal issues, such as the libel lawsuit, were threatening to ruin her, and while her work on the assassination might pay dividends in the future, there certainly were no guarantees. While from the outside, Dorothy seemed to have it all, that wasn't exactly the case. Her marriage was a sham, one which she'd come to terms with in the past, but still required her to pretend. The man she'd recently gotten involved with may have been using her for information, which he later leaked, or perhaps even, was working for an agency that wanted to know what Dorothy had found. It's public knowledge that the FBI had a file on her and that she was under surveillance, and so Dorothy may have felt trapped. People she trusted had betrayed her, her husband, her new boyfriend, and she was paranoid about who she could depend on when it came to the investigation. She concealed as much information as she could, believing that this was her best chance at avoiding dire financial straits. She received threats and felt that she was operating in a dangerous area where her life could be at risk. That's a lot of pressure for someone to be under. Factor in rumors of alcohol and possible drug abuse, and you certainly have a recipe for disaster. We've learned over the years, and we've experienced this every time a prominent figure chooses to end their own life, that regardless of how much someone seems to have, their level of success, their money, popularity, depression and stress combined with financial problems and work-related issues can become overwhelming and lead a person down a dark path. While Dorothy was very outspoken about being excited to break the JFK case open and had pending plans to fly down to New Orleans to speak with an informant, we can't know what may have occurred between the time she walked off the set of What's My Line and the moment of her death, nor for how long she could have been considering it. Some have argued that Dorothy had too much to live for, that she was dedicated to breaking open the assassination, and that she was determined to remain a prominent name in the news. This may indeed be the case, but considering the forensic evidence related to the autopsy, it's very difficult to imagine that this overdose was purely accidental. Dorothy Kilgallen was a foolish woman by no means, and rarely did anything without thinking about it and considering the possibilities. She had three children who she loved dearly, and an entire world of readers that she strove to captivate. But what if that simply wasn't enough? While it's disturbing to imagine that Dorothy may have committed suicide, it's a possibility which has to be considered. Perhaps this is why there are so many unanswered questions about the investigation, because it was done entirely to cover up the last act of a once powerful A-list darling of American history. On the other hand, many believe that Dorothy simply wouldn't have elected to end her own life and would have, if nothing else, walked away from the stress and difficulty of her job in hopes of starting anew. She was a tough woman who didn't let anything stand in her way, and so the idea that she wouldn't have just thrown it all out and started fresh somewhere else seems impossible to consider. America loves a comeback, and Dorothy hadn't even gone away yet. She certainly could have found a way to turn the tide back in her favor, or at least given her all to do so. We may never know the answer as to whether or not Dorothy made this grim and terrible choice, but we can't truly say it's 100% impossible. Sometimes, when we admire someone for the way they live, it's difficult to imagine they would choose such a method in the way they die. If indeed Dorothy Kilgallen's death was the result of a suicide, then the details about her body, the room, and the location of her files on the JFK assassination are merely red herrings that won't lead you anywhere. For some, that's enough of an answer, but for others, it simply doesn't make any sense. If Dorothy Kilgallen's death was purely the result of taking barbiturates, then it certainly seems more likely that the quantity of pills consumed might be more consistent with suicide rather than accident. That being said, a myriad of important questions relevant to knowing what truly happened have never been, and likely never will be, answered. The final theory in the death of Dorothy Kilgallen brings us into the possibility of homicide. Dorothy, throughout her life, certainly found a way to end up on the bad sides of powerful figures, including musicians, actors, and even agents within the intelligence apparatus of the United States. There are several aspects to this theory, and in the hopes of clarity, I will address them one at a time. The first name in a death investigation, which is often looked at, is the spouse or significant other, and in this case, that would be Richard Colmar. Richard and Dorothy had seen better days. The early joy and romance of their relationship had fizzled out before, and Richard had, allegedly, been involved in countless trysts and extramarital affairs. Dorothy had drawn a line between the 2 years earlier, so much so that while they maintained the same residence, it was mostly for the sake of appearances. They slept in separate rooms, engaged in outside relationships, and as a whole, were married purely for the sake of publicity at this point. Neither of them felt that it would be beneficial to their careers to officially divorce, and Dorothy's Roman Catholic upbringing didn't support that concept any better. At this point in time, Richard was well down a path of alcoholism and his career had been sinking for years. It was easy for many to see that there was certainly a level of jealousy involved. As is often the case in the hypocritical system of infidelity, some have implied that while Richard felt he was free to do as he pleased, he didn't appreciate Dorothy being out in public with other men and making him look like a fool. While friends and insiders were aware of their relationship status, fans, listeners, and viewers weren't, and so there was a notion that Richard, while accepting the fact that they were going to be seeing other people, didn't want it done in a manner in which the public might become aware. Late-night rendezvous at the Regency may have been done in a clandestine manner, but when you mix alcohol and jealousy into an equation, you don't always end up with logical thoughts. Richard's account of the timeline from that night has been proven inaccurate, though whether that was the result of deception or simply a man who had gotten his times mixed up, we may never know. If indeed Richard played a role in the death itself, then it seems strange that he would have staged it in such a bizarre manner as to almost invite questions. He would know that Dorothy's friend and makeup artist was coming over in the morning, so why not put Dorothy in the bed where she would usually be found? He'd certainly be familiar with her nightly routine and what she wore to bed, well enough to have made the scene look more convincing. On top of that, why not tuck Dorothy into bed rather than leaving her sitting up? Richard lived in the home. It wouldn't have been difficult to have spiked her drink and simply waited for her to fall unconscious in her own room. While Richard may indeed have resented his wife and had issues with her, she was also the primary financial tool in the home, and without her, that cash flow was bound to dry up. Now, maybe Richard felt that with Dorothy eliminated, he'd have unrestricted access to the funds that he desired, but would murder truly have been necessary? He knew she was seeing another man, and could have easily hired someone to get photographs in order to use that in court for financial gain. We know that things between the two weren't well, but we've never seen anything to suggest that Richard would have gone to this extent to take his anger out on her. If nothing else, were Richard involved, it seems likely he'd have published Dorothy's research in an attempt to make some money off of it, though he never did. Richard is certainly a possibility, but there doesn't appear to be much beyond rumor to connect him to Dorothy's death. There is an aspect of the homicide theory which implies that Dorothy may have been targeted by the mafia. This stems out of a theory connected to JFK that the mafia have been involved in some aspect of the assassination. Without diving deeply into that ocean of confusion, we'll try to look only at the mafia angle as connected to Dorothy herself. The theory argues that Dorothy's investigation may have exposed mafia members as being involved in the assassination, and so steps were taken to ensure that her research never reached the public. Under this angle, someone connected to the mafia would have murdered Dorothy and then stolen her research so that it could be destroyed. On the surface, this seems almost probable, but the more you look at it, the less sense it makes. The mafia isn't exactly known for murdering individuals by drugging them. Their approach is usually much more upfront and involves the use of a gun, especially in the 1960s. Dorothy was out that night, and if she were being followed by criminals with mafia connections, how hard would it have been for someone to have murdered her and made it look like a botched robbery or simply a random killing? Some argue that it has to do with Dorothy's files and that it was necessary to be in the same location where they might be retrieved. And so, whoever committed the murder would have had to have followed her home and gained entry. This would require that someone was able to get into the townhouse that night, drug and murder Dorothy, collect her file, and then exit without ever being seen or heard. Once the research was in hand, it wouldn't matter what the scene looked like. Sure, a blatant murder scene may have invited investigation, but it isn't exactly uncommon for mafia associates to commit a murder with little care or consideration for the investigation to come. Would a mafia hitman have gone through the trouble of changing Dorothy's clothes, moving her into a random bedroom, and setting the scene to appear as though no crime had been committed? Anything's possible, but it does seem to test the bounds of logic. Also, it's difficult to imagine that the mafia would have found the writing of a reporter very threatening, as it would hardly have been the first time a reporter implicated particular members in a crime. While the mafia angle is certainly intriguing, there's a lot of holes there that just don't seem to make sense. The third aspect of this theory argues that Dorothy's alleged boyfriend, Adam Ronald Pataki, may have played a role in her death. The reasons for his involvement have never been made adequately clear, and have been chalked up to his connection to intelligence agencies, jealousy, and all manner of motives which seem rather baseless. Much of Pataki's alleged involvement revolves around the suggestion that he was the mystery man Dorothy met the night she died, but that has never been proven beyond the shadow of a doubt either. Under the assumption that Pataki was in fact at the Regency that night, if pills are what was used to commit the crime, it isn't impossible to imagine that he could have been spiking her drinks that evening. It certainly wouldn't have been a complicated task to accomplish. But once you follow that line of thought, you end up at a dead end. How does Pataki then get a drugged-up Dorothy from the Regency into a car or cab, down to her townhouse, through the doors, into a random bedroom, without anyone seeing it? It seems a rather strange scenario to imagine. Some have implied the possibility that Pataki may have accompanied Dorothy home and induced the drugging once they were inside, but would Dorothy have been in the habit of bringing other men to the townhouse for a nightcap when Richard was there? Surely Richard had done something similar, but it does seem a bit out of the ordinary for this to have happened, especially when the two had spent their evening in a hotel lounge and, according to Pataki's own words, they frequently met at that hotel. It seems much more logical to simply take the elevator up to a room. Physically, it was certainly possible that Pataki could have been involved in the murder. It isn't impossible for him to have spiked Dorothy's drinks, to have been in her home, or to have staged the scene following the murder, but no one's ever been able to answer why. Pataki didn't go on in his life to commit numerous murders. He didn't appear to have anything to gain from Dorothy's death, and following it, he returned back to a life of obscurity in Ohio, with his one connection to celebrity, prestige, and prominence now gone from the world. While Pataki could have done this, it's difficult to see any reason why he would have done this. He's certainly someone that I agree should be questioned about that night, and likely has been, but in terms of a connection being established well enough to indicate that he might have been involved in Dorothy's death, there's just not currently enough there to make it seem likely. This leads us to the final aspect of the homicide theory, and the one for which many people argue in favor, that Dorothy Kilgallen was covertly murdered by members of the CIA, FBI, or some combination of intelligence and/or military agencies, in hopes of silencing her investigation into the assassination. You have to bear in mind that there's a strict dividing line here. If you believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin, and that there is in fact no conspiracy in the JFK assassination, then it's going to be difficult for you to believe that any member of any agency would find murder necessary to cover up this investigation. However, if you're one of the ones who believe that there's a lot more to what happened in Dealey Plaza that day in November of 1963, then this theory carries quite a bit of water. In order to follow this theory, you have to at least accept the premise that there was a conspiracy in the assassination of John Kennedy. We know for a fact that Dorothy had a contact either inside or with access to the Warren Commission, who leaked pages to her which she later published. These leaks resulted in her being questioned by the FBI, who were already keeping tabs on her in response to stories she had written about Cuba and the Soviet Union. For any member of the government, at any level, to want to silence Dorothy, there would have to be the risk that she would uncover something which they hoped to keep secret. Theorists in this category connect Dorothy to a long line of names of individuals who died under mysterious circumstances after having been either witnesses to the assassination, investigators into it, or by being connected to someone who was. What's always been curious to me about this angle is that Dorothy was under surveillance, so it seems hard to imagine that she could have come into contact with people who presented her with information that the government wished to keep secret. On the other hand, she did manage to have a private interview with Jack Ruby, the contents of which have never been revealed, and he later died 2 years after Dorothy, though his death was attributed to lung cancer. Other investigators who spoke with Ruby also met their ends in a bizarre fashion, but there were some who spoke with him and lived on. Ultimately, what you have to ask here is, what could Dorothy Kilgallen have discovered which would have required her life to have been ended? Remember, Jim Garrison actually launched a trial in the assassination, claiming conspiracy, and while he was subject to audits, harassment in the media, and alleged events related to intelligence agents threatening him, he certainly wasn't killed, and a man who could actually bring a case to trial would certainly seem like more of a threat to the establishment than a woman who could simply write about it. Perhaps it was a matter of popular opinion, and they simply didn't want her talking about it. Maybe she'd gotten on their nerves one time too many, and the decision was made to eliminate her. Either way, this would require a bizarre set of circumstances. An agent, or agents, related to any number of organizations would have been required to murder Dorothy, steal her research, and then stage the scene to appear as though she'd overdosed accidentally. It's possible Dorothy could have been injected with barbiturates in order to reveal the results on an autopsy, and considering the nature of that autopsy, it isn't hard to imagine that she may not have been examined thoroughly enough to reveal a possible needle mark. That being said, Dorothy could simply have been drinking that night and then, in a drunken state, had something orally injected which could have resulted in her death just as easily. When it comes to this angle, there are a lot of possibilities but very little to go on. While I don't consider myself a conspiracy theorist, at least not in the way that it's generally identified today, it's not completely out of the realm of possibility to imagine this could have happened. It would hardly be the first time that someone from an intelligence agency was connected to the death or attempted death of a prominent figure. The question becomes, was Dorothy's work threatening enough to necessitate murder in this manner? We may never know, since her files vanished. But if the murder was committed by anyone other than an agency looking to eliminate that information, wouldn't that individual then have to be at risk for being in possession of Dorothy's research? It's absolutely intriguing, and I can totally understand why it's become such a popular theory. Dorothy's death does leave a lot of questions unanswered, and almost anything connected to the assassination of John Kennedy tends to get a lot of other angles attributed to it in terms of conspiracy. I have to work on facts, and factually speaking, there isn't anything strong enough here. We have rumor, speculation, and suggestion, but nothing solid. While for many, Dorothy's death had to have been more than a simple accident or suicide, as in all cases, it comes down to what you can prove. The murder angle has brought out a great number of theories, but little with a solid basis to make that connection. While I don't necessarily believe that we have the entire story when it comes to the death of Dorothy Kilgallen, I also can't grant too much credence to theories which lack adequate support. Murder is certainly a possibility, though the reason for it and the person responsible will likely, sadly, never be known. There are countless unanswered questions. Why was there so much nicotine in Dorothy's blood when she wasn't a smoker? How could it have been accidental if the level of barbiturates in her system was that high? Why was she in a different room wearing different clothing? And ultimately, what happened to her research files? These questions continue to echo some 53 years later. The death of Dorothy Kilgallen is a mystery which has existed for more than 50 years, depending on your perspective. The brilliant, sharp, and remarkably talented woman either died in a manner which screams of conspiracy, or in a way which fails to equal the strong and vivacious way in which she lived her life. At the end of the day, a great talent was lost to the world, and a mother was lost to her children. Amidst all of the debate about how Dorothy died and whether or not there was a grand conspiracy, history has lost track of one of the most popular, powerful, and influential women to ever write for a newspaper or grace a television screen. Remember, Dorothy came along before Watergate, before 24-hour news networks and rating wars on social media, before prominent journalists had openly torn apart facets of government and shown the possibilities of corruption. She had the courage and the tenacity to ask the questions that others dared not to. Perhaps the true legacy of Dorothy's life was to dare to ask the questions that no one else would, but at the same time, it's important to never lose sight of the reason you need to know. Dorothy's life was a complicated one, with twists and turns, rumors and speculation, spy games and intrigue, but it was also that of a strong woman who should be remembered today for more about the things she accomplished than the manner in which she was lost. If you're interested in finding more information about Dorothy Kilgallen, there are many news articles, forums, and documentaries covering her story. Many books have touched on the subject, including Kilgallen, A Biography by Lee Israel, and The Reporter Who Knew Too Much by Mark Shaw. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Special thanks goes to Patreon producers Krista Colvin, Lynn Merschel, and Diane Dyson. If you have time, perhaps you can visit podcastawards.com and help nominate Trace Evidence. The procedure is simple. Click on Listener Nominations, register, and then vote for Trace Evidence in the People's Choice Award and Society and Culture sections. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you're using. The more ratings and reviews the show gets, the more people are able to hear these unsolved cases. For more information about other cases, transcripts, media, and more, please visit the website at trace-evidence.com. I want to thank you for listening to this episode. I'm going to leave you with a promo for another podcast which I thoroughly enjoy listening to, and I hope you will too. So join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
From the earliest British settlements on the shores of Virginia to the treacherous swamps of Louisiana and the isolated mountains of Appalachia, the American South has a rich history filled with eerie legends and mysterious hauntings. Join me, Brandon Schecksnyder, as I journey into its underbelly, exploring these tales of loss and heartbreak, tortured souls and spirits of the past, documenting ghost stories and legends amidst rich soundscapes and an eerie original soundtrack that can only be found on my podcast, Southern Gothic.